Does power corrupt, or are corrupt people drawn to power? Are entrepreneurs who embezzle and cops who kill the outgrowths of a bad system, or are they just bad people? Are tyrants made, or are they born? Now, if you were thrust into a position of power, would new temptations to line your pockets or torture your enemies gnaw away at you until you gave in? Stick around, folks. We're about to discuss with the author of the new book, Corruptible, Brian Kloss. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Now, I'm hoping y'all had a great Thanksgiving. Your bellies are nice and full. You had time to spend with loved ones that you hadn't been around in over a year. I'm sure that went well. But it's good to have you join us and be a part of the conversation again. And I'm excited about our guest, as you heard in the beginning, a little bit of a tease about the author of the new book, Corruptible. I'm excited to welcome Brian Kloss, who grew up in Minnesota. He's you know, but he's living in Europe now, so we'll forgive him. But he's a Minnesotan. He's a good brother. Earned his DPhil, Doctor of Philosophy. at Oxford University, and is now a professor of global politics at University College London. He is also a weekly columnist for the Washington Post, so I'm sure you've read a lot of his work there. Host of the award-winning Power Corrupts podcast and a frequent guest on national television. Brian has conducted field research, and this is important for what we're going to talk about so you understand where this brother's coming from. He's done the work, folks. He's done the research across the globe, interviewing despots, CEOs, torture victims, dissidents, cult leaders, criminals, and everyday power abusers. He has also advised major politicians and organizations, including NATO, the European Union, and Amnesty International. And why he joins us is, as you got from the tease coming in, he's written a new book, Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. And this book, as I said to Brian before we started this conversation, when I was reading it, it's like this man has been in my head. he's hitting all the right tones. Brian, welcome to the podcast, bro.
Oh, it's so great to be here.
Absolutely. So, okay. So there are a lot of different places that we can start with your book. But as I noted, coming in, and I want to go back to it because I think it's important at the very beginning, in the tease to our conversation. I started in the introduction, and in the introduction, you kind of asked some questions, which I thought were very important questions. Does power corrupt, or are corrupt people drawn to power? Let's start there, because I think a lot of people don't get that right most of the times. What do you say?
Yeah, I mean, so the answer is that it's both, but it's a much more complicated story than that sort of witty cocktail conversation of somebody saying power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, and then you move on, right?
Right.
I mean, I think there's a much more interesting thing that's happening. And what I mean by that is, yes, power-hungry people are drawn to power, and they're better at getting it, and they're better at holding on to it. Good people who go into power get corrupted. So that's a pretty bleak picture. Mm-hmm. But the really important thing that we often don't talk about is that the political culture, the system around people, matters a lot. So there's a story I tell, a study that I point to early on in the book, that looks at a study where they asked people to roll a dice, 42 times, and they say, we'll give you more money if you roll sixes, but you self-report, you tell us what you got, so you can lie on the report. Mm-hmm. And when they did the study in India, where the civil service, the bureaucracy, is notoriously corrupt, all the people who lied, including one guy who wrote that he got 42 sixes in a row, they all...
Well, there's nothing about... Hey, there's nothing like brazen. Trying, right?
Yeah, you might as well try. So, but in India, where they've got a corrupt civil service, the people who lied on the dice rolls to get more money, they all wanted to become civil servants. When they did the exact same study in Denmark, it was the exact opposite. In other words, all the honest people wanted to become civil servants.
Interesting.
And I think that says something really profound about, you know, the leadership we get, it's also a reflection of us. It's a reflection of our culture and our systems.
See, and that's where you got me with this book, because it, for the last, oh gosh, many years, I have been preaching that one point, particularly during the Trump era. And when I look at people go, well, what's going on inside the Republican Party? I said, the leadership is reflecting what the people want. I mean, you know, people talk about, you know, going in the 2020 cycle, oh my God, hair on fire. I'm like, folks, you don't realize we're here because this is where we want to be. If we don't want to do crazy anymore, guess what? We don't do crazy. It's like when you go to that party and things start getting a little buck wild, you have two choices. You can either go to the host and say, dude, this is crazy off the chain. This is not right. We need to stop. Or you can engage. Now, there's a third, you can leave, but that's probably not necessarily the way it's going to play out, if we're honest, right? So you really put your finger on an important part of this, is that people kind of, do they live vicariously through these folks, to this kind of leadership, that the rest of us look at the men and women in power as corrupt as they are and just turn a blind eye to it? What is that relationship like between the people and the despot?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll use a basketball analogy here, because I think it works both on the side of why people seek power and also why the system determines who actually gets power. So, you know, if you have a basketball tryout at a high school, you're not going to expect the people who come to that tryout to be average height. You're going to expect them to be taller than normal, right? That's the same thing with power. People who are power hungry put their hat in the ring more anytime you have a position of immense authority. Now, at the same time, if you're a coach that runs, you know, a series of point guards and has a three-point shooting strategy, well, it's going to mute that a bit, right? There are ways, the same is true for power. You can have a system that's really clean, or you can have a system that's really dirty. The dirty systems draw in the bad people. The clean systems draw in the good people. Now, what I'm worried about, and I think this is an extension for what you said before about the Republican Party, is that the local leadership now is the national leadership in, you know, 10 years or 15 years.
Right.
And what's happening at the local level is, you know, people who are good, decent public servants that want to volunteer to be a school board member or close to volunteer, they get very small pay. You know, those people are getting death threats now. They're facing right. harassment because they're approving mask mandates in schools, like the public health experts suggest. And what's happening is those people are just bowing out. They're just saying, this is too dirty for me. I don't want to get involved with politics. It's right. not worth it. Whereas the people who are power hungry are like, bring it on. You know, let's do this. And so, you know, my worry is that if you have a political culture that's rotten, you're going to get rotten leaders. So that's what's happened in the United States over the last.
But Brian, wait a minute, hold up. But okay, I buy that. But then, If you have a political culture that's rotten, you get rotten leaders. What if you don't, if the political culture isn't rotten and you still get rotten leaders? Now, it may be a little bit spoiled because nothing's perfect. We get that. But you know what I'm talking about. I mean, how do you account for that in your studies on this?
Yeah, so there's a chapter in the book called The Power Delusion, and this speaks to what you were asking before about why do we pick bad leaders? Because some of this is just on us, right? I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but we often, a subset of our population gravitates towards the wrong people. I start, by the way, with this amazing story of this industry in China. It's called the white guy in the tie industry, and I interviewed this guy who, he basically had no experience and was asked to go on a plane to bring a suit and a tie and nothing else with no experience and to pose as a quality control person at a factory in rural China, simply to give the veneer of legitimacy because the Chinese investors said, oh, it's a company from California that's really interested in our factory. And he was involved in this ribbon cutting. I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous, right? But it's about the appearances. There's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on when we select leaders that has to do with appearances. So one of the things that's really depressing, but we have to grapple with, is that we are drawn to people who have overconfidence and who often provide certainty in times of crisis, and the strongman personality appeals to a certain subset of the population. Now, I interviewed some evolutionary psychologists about this, which is it's a field I didn't know a lot about before I wrote the book. But basically what they look at is they say, look, you know, our brains haven't changed that much in the last 200,000 years. We basically have the same brain we always did mm-hmm. as the hunter-gatherers and the Stone Age people did.
Right.
But our lifestyles changed completely. So there was an evolutionary advantage to following a big, strong male in a time of crisis in the past, right?
Brother's going to fight the bear for you.
Exactly, exactly. And so what they find is that when they do studies and they say, who do you want to be your leader? You know, there's all sorts of different outcomes that come out of those studies. But if you prime people and you say, you know, it's a time of war or there's some sort of immigration crisis, something like that, all of a sudden the statistics get skewed completely and people gravitate towards the bigger man. I mean, which is ridiculous, but it's something that we have to grapple with. And there's a lot of stuff like that. The more that you dig, where it's like, there is actually these templates that are inside of our brains that we end up picking leaders for very stupid reasons. And I think we have to acknowledge that in order to counteract it.
Yes, we do. Please just acknowledge the obvious. Well, sometimes we pick leaders for really stupid reasons. And just, that's a book right there. So, okay, man, this is so good and exciting because there's so many lanes we can go down now. So I'm going to pick one that kind of continues on with us, because I believe the genesis of our leadership crisis is not the corruption of the individuals who ultimately become the president, the governor, the fill in the blank, the leader, but what we as citizens just accept. I mean, and I think you put your finger on part of that is, well, he said that he was going to deal with all these immigrants coming across the border, even though I live 3,000 miles away from the border. Or he said he was going to, you know, provide an easy transition out of Afghanistan, and that was a cluster, you know what. Do we project in such a way that we begin to make excuses and we sort of become depressed about it and then overreact to that depression? In other words, things get tough, the promise wasn't kept, so then you look to the next thing or person that comes along that makes a bigger, bolder promise, you know, and I'm going to build a wall, or, you know, I'm going to end, you know, fill in the blank as we know it. How do we continue to feed into that if at the end of the day, you kind of recognize that this is really probably a stupid reason to pick someone to lead my business, to lead my country, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is down to partisan tribalism. And I think that's one of the big problems where we actually readily accept worse leaders if they're part of our team, so to speak. There's a study I point to in the book that I found just so depressing, which is they had this task that they had people participate in. And they said, you know, you can have your team leader be this person or that person. And they showed them all this information about their choice. And one person was from their university. So it was a series of students, but they were legitimately like an objectively way worse. They had a way worse track record at solving the task or whatever. And then there was another option from a rival university who had like a perfect score. And the students always picked the one from their university, even though it was the bad performer. And there's another study that I found just so interesting about how we can rationalize things depending on constraints that are put on us. So this is one of the best studies I think ever produced, but it's called the Good Samaritan study. Mm-hmm. And basically what they did was they had these students who were studying to be in seminary, right? They're religious, future religious leaders.
I can relate.
And, yeah. And so they said to them, okay, what we want you to do is we want you to prepare a talk about the Good Samaritan parable from the Bible. And then you're going to go to this other building to deliver that sermon about it. What they didn't know is that between building A and building B, there was an actor who was somebody who was posing as someone seriously in pain. And the alleyway was so narrow that they had to physically step over the person to get to the second building. So they had to basically live out the Good Samaritan story and ask, okay, are you going to stop or not? Now, what they did to change it was a third of the people were told, you know, you've got plenty of time. Don't worry about it. A third we're told you can make it, but sort of hurry. And a third we're told you're already late. You better, you know, get your butt in gear. And the third who were told to hurry just stepped over the Good Samaritan. And he was writhing around on the ground. Almost all of them didn't stop.
Oh my God.
And it's as they're about to go and give a talk about this parable of helping someone in need. Oh, and so you think, okay, you know, what is the lesson for our politics, right? I mean,
I don't want them preaching to me on the pulpit. Yeah. That's for sure.
I think that has a profound lesson for our politics, though, where people can rationalize stuff, right? I mean, they end up in a system and they sort of say, okay, they get their blinkers on and they think, all that matters is that our side wins. I'm going to do the proverbial stepping over of the Good Samaritan. I'll crush my principles if it means we win this race. And I think that's what happened to a lot of Republicans during the Trump era. They just sort of figured, you know what? I'm late. You know, it's that sort of mentality of I've got to get from point A to point B, and who cares who I step over or what I lose behind in the process.
That is such a great example. Such a great example, and really speaks to the idea inside the Republican Party, for example, that on the heels of Barack Obama, who a lot envisioned as this mad socialist, for whatever reason, then, you know, who gave us Obamacare, you know, nationalized our healthcare. Then you move into the land of Bernie Sanders, where, you know, all the horrors of a democratic socialist and, you know, and Elizabeth Warren and, oh my God, what they're going to do to us in the environment, you know, AOC, there is this, you're like, we're too late, that they're already beginning. And oh my God, you've thrown in transgendered bathrooms? No, you know, so they're all of a sudden they see themselves pressed up against time to stop these things from happening. That makes so much sense in terms of the strong man who I referred to Trump as the quintessential P.T. Barnum of our age. Mm-hmm. Who not only recognizes that there's a sucker born every minute, but he's gotten it down to every 30 seconds. So he can just keep it going. But it's playing on that sense of desperation, knowing that people feel a certain way about immigrants. So we'll build a wall, makes them feel better. They feel a certain way about big social programs. So we'll cast every Democrat as a socialist. And claim that, you know, not only are they coming for you across the border, but when they get here, whatever jobs are left, they're going to take or send off to China, or you're going to find your son, your daughter in the bathroom with a guy who's just claiming he's a woman. You know, so, and it's just this fear thing. How much does that drive a lot of this? Because it's not logical. And it goes back to, you know, picking leaders for really dumb reasons making poor choices. What does fear play into that in what you've been able to see?
I think it plays a big role. And I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that these fear primers. So like when you're told that something is a crisis, the American Carnage speech, right, that Trump gave early on in his inauguration, that speech is tailor-made to activate the fear response in people. And, you know, when you do this, when you prime people with fear messages, they change which leaders they select. As I told you before, size matters more. One of the things they did is with height even, right? I mean, presidents often get elected if they're taller than their opponents. There was an Australian politician, a woman who read this and broke her legs and had them physically stretched 3 inches to try to win election. And she did, although she didn't read the evidence carefully enough, because the effect only matters for height for men. So that there's a statistically significant measure for men, but not for women when it comes to height. But I also think, you know, one of the things that I point out in the book, and this obviously has relevance for Trump, is that there's this trait of psychology called the dark triad. It refers to Machiavellianism, narcissism, and psychopathy, being a psychopath. Now, I'm not a, you know, clinical psychologist. I'm not going to go there by saying Trump necessarily is a sociopath or anything like that, but certainly the narcissism right. is obvious to everybody. Right. The Machiavellianism.
There's enough evidence that we can impute some.
Yeah, I'll let people connect the dots. Let's put it that way.
Exactly.
But my point is that when you look at the evidence for this stuff, I mean, these people are very good at getting into power, but they're dysfunctional when they actually wield power. And you saw this all the time with Trump, right? So narcissists actually are pretty good at getting power precisely because they care about their ego so much that they're constantly managing it in ways that sometimes can help them rise. Now, for Trump, it became toxic because he couldn't stop tweeting about, you know, the interview or the negative hit piece on him that he perceived as a slight when he needed to be presidential. And so one of the things that I think is important to think about for reforming this is if we accept that dark triad traits make you better at getting into power, maybe we should change the ways we elevate people. So in business, for example, right, this is outside the realm of Trump and so on, but in business, the job interview format is perfect for somebody who is superficially charming, narcissistic, and Machiavellian. They lie, they charm you. They've got to put on a performance for 45 minutes.
Right.
And so those people rise through the corporate ranks, you know, really quickly, but they're terrible when they get to the top. They're really, really bad at wielding power. So my point is, you start with the premise that worse people in society are going to disproportionately seek and get power. And then you sort of try to counteract that as best you can with reforming systems to make sure that those people get screened out and spit out as soon as they try to put their hat in the ring.
So tell us about meerkats.
Okay, sure.
and how we are a little bit like them.
Yeah. So meerkats, and I talk about meerkats and African wild dogs in the book.
I know. I love that part. Right? Yeah, I was searching for that, but I highlighted it. Yes.
Yeah. So meerkats have this call that they make that basically says, you know, let's go over there. And they're trying to get the pack to move. And African wild dogs sneeze when they want to get the pack to move. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting, what's different about them is the meerkats, it completely depends on the confidence of the meerkat. So if the meerkat is super confident with its move call, they're more likely to follow it. For the African wild dog, status matters. So if the sort of alpha male dog sneezes, they're likely to go. But if it's the bottom of the pack, you need sort of five or six or seven dogs to sneeze in unison to get everybody to move.
Right.
And I think humans are halfway between, right? So obviously people who are higher up wield way more clout in our societies. But overconfidence and this sort of sense of certainty, even if it's false certainty, moves people. And again, this is where we go back to that strange world of evolutionary psychology, because there used to be a benefit to this, right? Mm-hmm. So if you were dying of thirst in the Stone Age, if somebody said, oh, I definitely know that there's a pond over that hill, I mean, there's a sort of rational reason for following them because you're going to die otherwise, right? So you're going to die of thirst. So in the past, taking the risk with somebody who is overconfident actually made some evolutionary sense. Now it's just stupid, but we still do it. We still follow people who are overconfident, never uncertain, but often wrong, right? And that's a real problem for our society. It's something that I think we need to take a reckoning with, that when people are seriously wrong repeatedly, maybe we should stop listening to them. We're not very good at doing that.
Oh my God. It's always the simple stuff we get screwed up. And that to me is fascinating. Because when you look at the example of the meerkats and the African wild dogs, how would you extrapolate that? Because as you've alluded to earlier, as much as we think we've evolved, we really haven't. Except for some other types of social constructs that we put together and maybe some behaviors, we're still not that far removed from, you know, the biggest caveman, you know, with the biggest stick making the loudest noise and everyone going, okay. How have these hierarchies evolved such that we continue to contribute to them the way we do, and they become almost self-perpetuating because no one stops and goes, he's just a bad leader or she's just a bad boss, and you know, we just need to not do this anymore. Yet the hierarchies, very much as I've seen inside the political parties, don't want that. It's like the, it's almost a self-protection mechanism that's kind of created. How have you found that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, again, this speaks to some of the superficiality of how we choose who's in charge. And so I'll start with one example from that, and then I'll move to some of the more systemic things that you're talking about here. So early on in the book, I talk about this study that's about faces and how they affect who we select as leaders. And there's a story where they gave children basically these choice between two faces and said, who do you want to captain your imaginary ship in this computer game? And what the kids didn't know was that the faces weren't random. One of them was the winner of a French election and one was the runner up in the French election. And overwhelmingly, the substantial majority of the time, the kids picked the winner to captain their ship, which suggests that faces actually have a lot to do. I mean, this whole political consulting industry we have might be grappling with the fact that people are making very superficial judgments about politicians early on. Now, that then goes into some other aspects of our society that are really problematic, like things with misogyny and racism. And so, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is there's this discussion of the snowy peaks or the vanilla boys problem in corporate and political hierarchies. And something I talk at length about in the book is that when people are thinking about going into a position of power, they're way more likely to put their hat in the ring if they believe that someone like them fits in, right? And so one of the things that you see this all the time, I talk about this with policing, for example, where I found this video on Doraville, Georgia's police department. It was a small police department outside of Atlanta. And the video they have on their website was, you know, these guys in military fatigues with smoke grenades in a tank flashing the Punisher video on screen. And it's got this heavy metal, you know, sort of death band. And that's sort of the video that greets people. Well, I mean, okay, it's all white men, it's all militaristic. And if you're sort of somebody who's not like that, are you going to apply for that police department? The New Zealand Police Department, they tried to counteract that. They said, look, we know that there's certain types of people who are less drawn to a gun and a badge than the stereotypical cop, which is disproportionately white, male, and more power hungry. And so they designed a recruitment scheme that was very funny and aimed at representing different types of people in the police. And the video they had, rather than them going around in a tank and, you know, shooting guns and throwing hand grenades out, it had them chasing an unseen perpetrator, which at the end is a dog that's stolen a purse, right? And on the screen, it says, do you care enough to be a cop? And it's like completely the opposite of this Doraville, Georgia thing.
That would not work here in the US.
Yeah, well, but I mean, the thing that's amazing about it, though, is that it worked in New Zealand in the sense that they didn't have quite the skew that we do, but they did have a massive change in the applicants that applied to be police officers. They had way more women, way more ethnic minorities after this ad campaign was put out.
But real quick on that point, did they think, I mean, okay, so let's talk about the people who are coming in the door. Do they expect that that's what being a police officer is? Or, I mean, because being a police officer is probably the cult, everything else is going to skew more towards the other side of that, where you're going to be in situations where it's going to be like a heavy metal video with, you know, a lot of guns blazing, noise and screaming.
Well, I mean, I think that's true if you're talking about the NYPD, but I mean, you know, Doraville, Georgia has got 10,000 people. So it's you know, a lot of these small town police departments are not like that. Right. But even still, I mean, yeah, of course there are deployments of those kinds of cops in New Zealand, but they're a subset of the police department, right? You want people with a military background, for example, in SWAT teams. It makes complete sense.
Right.
But I think that you start from the perspective that you need to try to counteract some of the aspects of power and how it attracts some of the wrong kind of people, right? And there's a lot of great people who want to be cops, a lot of great people in police departments around the United States. But when I talked to people from, for example, London's police department, they said, look, overwhelmingly, our police are great. But if you are someone who's a bully or a bigot, then the idea of being a bully or a bigot with a badge and a gun is pretty appealing to those people, right? So you have to try to screen them out. And what New Zealand was trying to do is just simply counteract it. And I think the more profound point is that it shows that when you try to recruit the sort of non-stereotypical person, sometimes it can be very helpful. And I think that's true for our politics too, right? Like one of the reasons I wrote this book was because there was this dichotomy between every time I talk to people around me, you know, in the US and the UK, wherever, they're always like, all the people I know are good and decent. You know, like they're all nice people. Why is it that every time we have leaders, there's scandal after scandal and there's abuse of power? Why is there this big mismatch? And I think one of the reasons is, as I said before, I think we've set up in politics in the United States a toxic environment that isn't attractive to people who don't want power, who just want to serve. I think that those people, especially right now, they see the vitriol and they think, no, count me out. You know, I'll have to raise money nonstop. Everybody's going to scrutinize every part of my life, and I'll probably get death threats constantly. So, you know, there's some of that that I think we need to make power palatable to the right kind of people and proactively recruit people for whom power is actually not a desire, but they would see it as a burden.
As someone who's considering a possible run for governor of the state of Maryland, I can identify with that last series of points. Is it going, okay, what am I getting into again? My wife looks at me like, "Are you? What part of your brain has shut down that you want to go back into public service after what we've seen over the last 10 or 12 years? We're having a wonderful conversation with my buddy, Brian Kloss. He is the author of the new book, Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. We're going to have more with Brian right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
Welcome back, everybody. Michael Steele here. Great conversation with the author of the new book, Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. None other than Brian Kloss. You can follow him on Twitter at Brian Kloss. That's K-L-A-A-S. And so, Brian, I wanted to get into, I got to pull it up real fast because I loved this this part of the book. It was the chapter 6, Bad Systems or Bad People. And you start off with the great question. It was the best way you could tease the opening here. You go, what can you learn about humanity by watching how people behave while sipping coffee at Starbucks? In fact, turns out quite a bit. Tell us about that experiment, which really, I thought it was almost like the Good Samaritan experiment, but on a much grander scale, that really kind of put a finger on a lot of the cultural and other indicators of how we wind up the leaders we end up with.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I found these studies fascinating. And basically what it comes down to is something called Rice theory. So Rice theory is this idea that if you come from a community that cultivates rice, then you are more likely to be communitarian and sort of, you know, rely on your neighbors, because you can't have a successful rice crop unless you coordinate with all the people around you. You can't make it in on your own. Whereas if you're from an area that cultivates wheat, you're more likely to be individualistic. Now, that's because wheat can be made on your own. You don't have to care about whatever anyone else is doing. This sounds like a lunatic theory, right? I mean, it sounds completely crazy. But they looked at this in China, and China, you know, you can look at the same, it's the same country and, you know, thousands of years of history, but there are certain sections of China that are wheat producing, certain sections that are rice producing.
Right.
And what they found is that when they did a series of studies, one of them was at Starbucks, and they looked at, okay, how many people sit alone at Starbucks, or are you constantly with your friends? And also another thing about this is they would set up this chair in the aisle at Starbucks. Yeah. All this is in China.
Right.
And they'd check whether people would move around the chair because it's blocking their way, or whether they pick up the chair and put it back. And these examples are things that reflect individualism versus sort of a more collectivist or communitarian right. mindset, because people who move the chair, they're more individualistic. People who move around it are more communitarian. Right. And the same for solo sippers at Starbucks versus people who go to Starbucks with their friends. It reflects these divides. And sure enough, the divides were very, very strong in terms of these backgrounds in the different regions of China. And of course, if you run these studies in the United States, you get totally different responses. It's the same sort of thing. It's a much more individualistic culture. So there's a lot more solo sippers and a lot more people moving the chair. Now, what I try to do with this knowledge is I say, okay, there's a lot of stuff that affects our behavior, right? We behave the way we do for a lot of reasons, but surely the systems we come from matter a ton. If even the cultivation of right. crops in our area affects our behavior, then surely, you know, the corporate culture, the political culture is going to do more of an effect on us than other things. So one of the areas I love in this book is the weirdest thing I did probably was I flew out to Vermont, where Paul Bremer lives. He's the guy who ran Iraq in 2003. He's now a ski instructor in Vermont. And I took a ski lesson with him. And what I found interesting about Paul Bremer is that, you know, whatever you think of him, whatever you think of his record on Iraq, he had served with distinction when he was an ambassador to Norway and some other places. Mm-hmm. And then he gets to Iraq. And one of the first meetings he holds, he asks the question, can we shoot the looters? Can we shoot the people who are stealing TVs and so on and ransacking Baghdad? Now, I mean, if he had suggested that as the ambassador of Norway, he would have been recalled immediately, right? I mean, that's the end of it. And the point I try to make with him is, okay, so he ends up in Iraq. He's getting, he's getting bombed with mortar fire from Al-Qaeda, you know, offshoots and all these people affiliated with Saddam's regime. He's got a bounty of 10,000 grams of gold on his head by Osama bin Laden, which I think is a distinction unique to him as a Vermont ski instructor. But it's one of these things where you think, okay, he's in this horrible situation, this horrible system. He has to make very different calculations than he did when he was the ambassador to Norway. And then he comes back to the United States. I mean, the first thing he said to me when we're on the chairlift in this Vermont ski resort was we got stuck underneath the sort of chairlift tower. And he says, whenever I'm teaching kids, you know, I tell them it's lucky to get stuck here and they need to make a wish and then it will come true. And I'm like, this is not what I expected. You know what I mean? And I think the point is that we're much more chameleon-like than we like to believe. We morph depending on the systems that we live in. And I think that actually is quite hopeful because it means, you know, it's much easier to change systems than it is to change people. So in a way that gives us our political project and our political homework to do.
Yeah, it does in a lot of ways, but I still come back to the point that, and it really kind of, I guess it once that you confirm for me an idea that I put out there that when I look at our economy, our you know, healthcare and, you know, our race relations and all of these other systems that are out there, and then I look at our politics in the past, you know, you can make the case that all of those systems and the policies that sort of roils within them sort of dictated the political engagement, dictated the politics. The politics was a reflection of, you know, our desire to have better healthcare, or our desire to have lower taxes, or our desire to feed more people, whatever it happens to be. Today, we seemingly are in a position where our politics is dictating the outcomes of those particular systems. So the systems are no longer driving the politics are driving the systems itself. So we're more tribal, we're much more insular, we look suspiciously at each other. We've got political leaders like Representative Gosar, you know, threatening to kill other members via cartoons. And You've got, you know, other members, you know, on the left who are threatening their fellow members if they don't support a grand spending plan. So you have all of these, these threats and these this tension that's sort of blowing out of our political system, and I use the term infection, infecting all these other important systems that really can't afford to be infected. Do you kind of see it that way? Is that a good way to look at this, or am I looking at it a little bit skewed?
No, I think you're right. And I think this connects to something that you said earlier about how it's sort of a reflection of us sometimes too, and what's being demanded, that we're sort of in exactly the place that we want to be. I mean, at least not that we want to be, but that's a certain segment of the population wants us to be in. You know, I think the thing with Gosar, for example, or some of the vitriol that exists in politics, is it conditions the future leaders to behave in the same way. You know, I think that's why accountability is so important. I have one of the chapters that I have later on in the book is about how, you know, accountability really does matter. Oversight really does matter. It affects people's behavior. And I think when you see Gosar behave the way he did, I mean, he shared a video of him murdering somebody, right? And like any other job in America, he'd be fired for that.
Right.
And yet, you know, it's like we've set the bar lower in Congress than we have in corporate America over and over and over again. And well, what's that going to do? It's going to mean that there's going to be more people who behave like them, especially because the Republican base rewards it, right? I mean, one of the things that I think is really difficult, especially in places where it's a solid, solid, deep red district, let's say, you know, in the rural South,
right,
is that to differentiate yourself, you have to be more Trump-like. You have to be more Gosar-like. And there's no consequences to doing that. So it's an interaction between the sort of elite accountability and the demand from the base. And I think that's what's happening in the Republican Party right now, is that the elite accountability has disappeared. I mean, there's no shame, there's no consequences. When people used to sort of say, you know, I also think this is partly because of, and this is something I don't talk about in the book, but I think it's also partly because of the breakdown of party control to an extent. I mean, in the past, you wanted to go on Fox News, you're gonna have to play by the rules of, you know, the Mitch McConnell of the day or whatever. Now everybody has their own Twitter feed, and they can just sort of, you know, Lauren Boebert, who would be, you know, 25 years ago, she would have been a nobody hoping to rise up the ladder over two decades. You know, now she's broken out because she's become more extreme than the party, and that attracts a certain type of person to her political base. So, you know, it's the breakdown of sort of the accountability structure at the top, and then also the demand from the bottom that's always looking for the shock, the sort of extreme, and also, you know, I think, frankly, the entertainment. I mean, I think one of the things that really is a shame.
That's a big part of it.
And that's why when you say the P.T. Barnum, I think you're totally right, because politics has become about entertainment in the United States. And I think that's something where we really have to think long and hard about whether we want that kind of system where the real payoff is that we get amused rather than get problems solved.
Well, a couple of things. One, on the first point on the point you just made about the entertainment, there was, going back to the mid-90s, early 2000, a growing sense among the political class here in Washington. And I'm pretty astute and sort of keyed into those folks as I grew up here. This is my home. I grew up here. And so, you know, as a native Washingtonian, politics is in the blood, and you know how it ebbs and flows. And during that period, there was a growing concern about it. You can almost pinpoint the switch where, you know, we have the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, which is the big correspondents, you know, Washington correspondents, White House correspondents, journalists in town have this evening where the politicians and the journalists kind of get in a room and have fun and make fun of each other. Well, then they got to the point where, you know, folks were inviting folks out of Hollywood to come to the dinner. And it became, over time, this sort of star-studded affair, which was like almost like a mini Oscar night in terms of the anticipation, and you could see how people dressed up and how they behaved. And it grew to a point where the dinner had become much more about the who's who from Hollywood and theater and television that would show up, and journalists wanting to be seen with them and photograph with them and do the walk, you know, like the the walk where you come in and they take photos of you and so forth, more so than what it was intended to be about was journalism. Mm. And in an ironic way, Trump broke that because he didn't want to play, because he didn't want to be the subject of ridicule, which, you know, likely would have been the case, having been the subject of that at one of, I think, Obama's last, or next to last correspondence dinner. So, and at that moment, it sort of broke that mindset where they said, now we can take this opportunity to focus in on what we originally were about. This was not about going Hollywood. And so you see that kind of spill into our politics, where a lot of politicians now want the likes, want the glamour that comes from appearing on all these talk shows and you know, having people recognize them in restaurants and applaud them when they walk in a room and all this other crazy. And it's really kind of worn down the responsibility that they have as leaders, which then leads to the second part, the accountability that you touched on. How do you then, when you look at something like the January 6th Commission, even in that instance, in the face of an attempted overthrow of our government, no one wants to be accountable.
Yeah.
I mean, I let me rephrase that. It's not no one wants to be accountable. You have efforts by some to avoid accountability. How does that work in the context of this corrupting process that you tap into?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. This is a central aspect. Accountability is so important. And this is an area I talk about in the book. The one that, again, it's a study I love. It's about parking tickets in New York City, but it has lessons for January 6th.
Yes, go there.
So basically, up until the early 2000s, diplomats who worked for the United Nations had absolute immunity from parking fines because they were, you know, they had diplomatic immunity. So they could park wherever they wanted to. They might get their cars towed, but they didn't have to pay for anything.
Right.
And eventually, Bloomberg finally said, no, this is crazy. There's 150,000 unpaid parking tickets from diplomats at the United Nations. They owe us like $20 million. We're going to start enforcement. What was really interesting is when you started, right, at the beginning of this period, the Norwegians, the Danish, the Brits, they parked normally, right? They followed the rules. Whereas, you know, the Egyptians, the Pakistanis, a few of these more corrupt countries had a lot of parking tickets. And as soon as the enforcement period happened, all of a sudden, almost overnight, the Egyptians parked like the Norwegians. They just stopped. It just completely cleaned up the act. But the really interesting thing is, before the enforcement period, before there was actually any sort of fines to be paid, the Norwegians who were in New York longest parked illegally the most. So in other words, as they got away with it more, they started to say, you know what, I think I can test the rules a bit, you know?
Right.
So it's a perfect little experiment where it shows when you get away with stuff, you get worse. And when you get caught and you get punished, you get better. I mean, we know this intuitively, but there's a lot of evidence this is true. And so with January 6th, I mean, the point that I always make is you rightly describe it as an attempted overthrow of the government. I mean, if you don't punish that, what's going to happen next time? You know, I mean, I think that's the real problem, is that there's going to be a more sophisticated attempt sometime in the future. And people are not going to have got the message that this is something really, really serious.
Well, there is method to the madness of what Voltaire said, and you noted in chapter 12 of the book, where he said, if God didn't exist, we would have to invent him. And that's how you introduce us to the idea of lesson seven, as you called it. Mm-hmm. Watched people are nice people. And it really is, you know, when, if you want to alter behavior, then you have to put in place accountability. And that takes a myriad of forms, but it's important nonetheless that that accountability be there. So if you're going to park illegally, we're going to hold you accountable, meaning you're going to pay the fine. If you are going to engage in a certain type of behavior, we're going to hold you accountable, because we're going to watch that behavior. We're going to watch for that behavior. As we get ready to roll you up out of here, because I know you got to go and push the book, my friend. It's important. How would you sum this up for us? Because I thought that, you know, this was for me an important part of the book, When you go through the whole thing, at the end of the day, it is about accountability.
Yeah.
That's the anecdote to corruption and corruptible things. How would you sign it off? How would you?
Yeah. So I found this research fascinating because what I didn't know a lot about was this idea of how accountability throughout history was largely from religion, right? In most of the time that humans have graced the planet, we haven't had sophisticated police forces and journalists and oversight of the kind we do now. So what we used to have is just mortal fear of God, right? Most people were afraid that God was always watching them and would punish them either in this life or the next for something they did that was bad.
Let me check that box even in the 21st century.
No, exactly. So that's still true for billions of people around the planet. It's just some people it's less true for. But the thing that was really interesting about the sort of big God era of human oversight is that it was equal. Right? Whether you were a king or a peasant, God was watching you. What I think is a really big problem now, and we talked about this with Gosar and the sort of lower bar for Congress than many employees have in corporate America, is that powerful people have made it so the oversight doesn't go on them. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of your listeners will work in offices where they're potentially being monitored while they have, you know, while they're on their keyboard. Maybe they have to, you know, punch a clock.
Right.
All of the oversight is directed at the powerless people, right? I mean, Enron didn't get destroyed because somebody took a 15-minute lunch break when they weren't supposed to. It was because there was no oversight at the very top. And I think, you know, I think my point is the benefit of the big God era was that the powerful people feared oversight too. I think, you know, we have engineered systems where a lot of people in power get away with it because they don't get sufficient oversight, whereas the people who work for them are being monitored and surveilled and clocked
all the time.
All the time. And so I think we need to invert that a bit and actually pay a little bit more attention to oversight to our leaders.
Oh, man, I knew I would love this conversation, and I knew I would love seeing you again, Brian. It's been a while, and you've come with a tour de force. It is a great work. Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. The author is none other than Brian Kloss. He is just insightful in how he sort of peels back the curtain on a lot of questions we have about this time that we live in, how we got here, but more importantly, some of the steps that we can take as a society, as individuals, to turn things around. It's not as hard as we may believe sometimes, if we're willing to hold each other accountable. And Brian, you do that in this book, so we appreciate it, brother, very, very much.
Thanks for having me. It was a great conversation. I loved it.
Absolutely. Again, the book is Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us. Check it out. Get it on Amazon or wherever you get your books. Follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Kloss. And you can find him at brianpkloss.com, where you could probably also purchase the book. So nice little reading, gifts, for family members over the holidays, maybe, perhaps, I think so. so we can do that for a friend. Well, folks, that does it for this conversation. You know, I always love it when you step in and spend a little bit of time with us. Don't forget to check me out on Twitter at Michael Steele. Don't forget to do the download thing. You know how much I love it when you download because it makes me feel all yummy inside. Give us a 5-star rating. That also helps. Certainly helps the folks on my back end who are looking at that stuff. They feel good. Until next time, be safe, be well, wear the damn mask, get the damn vaccine, stop making excuses and listening to stupid people. You know better. Do the right thing. Your mama taught you better. Until next time, later.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, We are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us, the way Americans do, on a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news, weird politics, weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.